Open our Bibles to Judges chapter 16. I want to remind you of where we've been, and we'll dig right in here. Actually, tonight, I want to only officially cover the first three verses of chapter 16, but in a way, we're going to be kind of covering much of the theme of chapter 16, which will enable us to move through the rest of it rather quickly when the time comes. But if you recall, Samson was a child of promise. An angel of the Lord appeared to his mother and spoke to his father as well and told them they would have a son and he would be a Nazarite from birth. Nothing from the vine, nothing dead, and don't touch the hairs of your head. Those were the three parts of the Nazarite vow. And Samson, we find him as he grows up, he is not faithful to two of those three things. We see him in the vineyard and throwing a drinking party. All appearances are he likely participated. We know he definitely touched things that were dead. In fact, he created dead bodies on more than one occasion. But he was not someone who was faithful to everything, all the parts of that, or what he was supposed to be. He had a weakness, and his weakness was Philistine women. The Philistines were the oppressors of Israel, and he initially tried to marry one, and that didn't work out well. The whole situation with the riddle and his wife's betrayal and killing 30 men of Ashkelon and then back and forth, all these things happened. He went to go back to his wife, and his father-in-law had given her away to one of the other guys who cheated. With the riddle, and Samson, you know, is really upset over all those things and burned down their fields, and then they burned down the house of his father and a father-in-law and his wife, and so he goes and kills a whole bunch of men and just rips them apart, and then he goes and hides, and the Philistines send 1,000 people, and then the Israelites send 3,000 people and find Samson, take him back bound in ropes, then he breaks the ropes, finds the jawbone of a donkey, and he kills 1,000 Philistines. And right after that great, miraculous victory, he's dying of thirst. He's humbled and he's broken. He calls out to God to help him, and God causes a hollow place to spring forth water in the ground there, I believe, near where he was at. Samson named that spring. And he drank the water and was revived. He called it the spring of him who called. And we read in Judges chapter 15, verse 20, after that event, after Samson killed those 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of the donkey, he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. And so that would sound like the end of Samson's story, but it's not. In fact, I want to read through chapter 16 here for us. In fact, I may not read all of it, but I'm going to read some important key points here from chapter 16. And I want you to notice where we end up. So we just read that Samson judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. Samson went to Gaza, and there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her. The Gazites were told, "Samson has come here." And they surrounded the place and set an ambush for him all night at the gate of the city. They kept quiet all night, saying, "Let us wait till the light of the morning, then we will kill him." But Samson lay till midnight, and at midnight he arose and took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts and pulled them up, bar and all, and put them on his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that is in front of Hebron. After this, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, "Seduce him and see where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to humble him, and we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver." And then we read how Delilah begins to entice Samson to try to get him to tell her where his strength lies. Three times she tries. Finally, she succeeds. And we read that when Delilah saw in verse 18 that Samson had told her all that was on his heart, she called the Lord of the Philistines, saying, "Come up again, for he has told me all his heart. I know where his strength lies." He's never cut his hair. Then the lords of the Philistines came up and brought the money in their hands. She made him sleep on her knees, and she called the man and had him shave off the seven locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And he awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had left him. And the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze shackles. And he ground at the mill in the prison. And we go on and read. We'll read later what happens here. And we read down into verse 31. Then his brothers and all his family came down and took him. This is after Samson died. And brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of Manoah his father. He had judged Israel 20 years. Chapters 15 and 16 end with the same fact. Samson judged Israel 20 years. Remember that his judgeship was inaugurated or began with the battle of Jawbone Hill. God humbled him through thirst, and Samson cried out for deliverance. That's how his judgeship began. And although I didn't read all of that, that's how his judgeship will end. He will be humbled and call out to the Lord again, and he's able to bring a great victory in his death. And so his judgeship begins and ends with him calling out upon the Lord. Great bookends. But the things that were in between were not so glorious. Fundamentally, everything we've studied about Samson, he has not changed. That same young man who was smitten by that Philistine girl and insisted upon going and marrying her and having her for his wife, even though that was not what God's will was for him, God's desire for him. Now, God was going to let it happen and God was going to use it, but that's not what was right, what was good. He had a problem lusting after Philistine women. And that had not changed with Samson. And that had bit him before. That whole first marriage thing, all that happened there, how he was betrayed, all of that, he hadn't learned. He hadn't grown from the past lessons. And because he refused to grow and change, it would ultimately cost him his life. Back in chapters 14 and 15, the climax was Samson being delivered. But in chapter 16, really the climax of that is Samson being thrown into captivity. And one of the commentators I read described it this way. Yahweh sustains a seeking Samson versus Yahweh abandons a self-sufficient Samson. I thought that was pretty well put. When Samson was seeking, God was right there, holds him up. But when Samson can do it on his own and go away from what God wants, God left him. So what I want to focus on are just these first three verses of chapter 16. And really, these three verses, I thought, as I was preparing to study for this and going through it and kind of dividing things up, you know, there's not much to say here. There's not a lot of detail. In fact, it's honestly kind of confusing when you start digging in. Why are these three verses even here? What's going on? You don't hear a lot of facts. You just know that he went to Gaza. This is while he was a judge. He saw a prostitute. He went into the prostitute. So there's no confusion about what was going on. The Gazites heard Samson was there. These were Philistines. They surrounded the place. They were going to kill him in the morning. They set an ambush at the gate of the city. And Samson gets up in the middle of the night, goes, takes the gate, the post, everything, puts it on his back, and carries it to Hebron and sets it up on the hill of Hebron. And then we move on to Delilah. What's going on? Why is this here? Gaza was a really important Philistine city. I don't know that it was the capital per se, but it was near the Mediterranean coast. And so Samson had to go on a big journey to get there. Even today, the name Gaza remains in common usage in Israel. You've probably heard of the Gaza Strip, which still exists today. That's where this was. That's where Samson went. It was a really important area because a lot of the roadways that connected north to south would go along the Mediterranean coast because it was easier to travel there, and they went through Gaza. And so that was a happening place. It was an important Philistine city. It was, that area was at least very fertile for agriculture and crops and herds. And it was also the location of the Temple of Dagon, one of the chief Philistine gods. So it was an important place to the Philistines. It was a happening place. And Samson went there. What do we learn from the fact that Samson went to Gaza? Just kind of think about this. What can we pick up from just knowing that Samson decided to take a trip to Gaza, and he did? He still has a weakness for women. We're not told why he went, but we are told something significant he does when he gets there. And it's not good. Apparently, Israelites can still travel freely under this Philistine rule. They're not hiding in caves. And Samson being on the scene had probably allowed Israel to break free a bit. Obviously, the Philistines were scared of him. And Samson wanted to go there, and so he did. He wasn't content in Israel. Perhaps he wanted to go down to Gaza and have a good time. So he left Israel, the place where the Israelites lived, and went down to Gaza. Now, Gaza was part of Israel. It was supposed to be part of Israel. It was part of the tribal inheritance, but the Philistines had set up strongholds there. So what else, I think the Father already mentioned it, what else do we learn about Samson from verse 1? He's still attracted to Philistine women. And now, what's different from this occasion from the first? What's the difference between what we read here in chapter 16, verse 1, and what we read back in chapter 14, verse 1, when he went down to Timnah and saw a daughter of the Philistines? He went down to Timnah to have a good time, found a girl, but what was different about that situation?
He asked to marry her.
He at least wanted to be legitimate about it. We'll give him that much. Now, he just goes down and finds a prostitute. Plans to use her and fill his lust and his desire and then go on. Even though he had been humbled by God, and God had worked through him and had blessed him with a purpose and a ministry, fundamentally, Samson has not changed. In fact, in some ways, he's worse. He's gotten more cold and hardened to what's right. What do we learn about the Gazites, the Philistines, the Gazites, in verse 2? What do we learn from their response to Samson's presence in Gaza?
They wanted to kill him.
See what they can get him.
face, but in front of jumping.
So we see with Samson, the first time there was an issue, it was in Timnah, which was way north. And then he went south to Ashkelon, which is still north of Gaza, and that's where he killed those 30 men. And then the Philistines, I think in the Timnah area, sent 1,000 men or so to go get Samson. But that was all the northern area. Now he's down south, and the people of Gaza see Samson there, and they plan to kill him. And so we kind of see that Samson was no longer just a regional problem among the Philistines. He was like a national pariah. He was the bad guy. The Philistines, they all knew about Samson, and they all wanted to get rid of him. And even though Samson, we don't read of anything he had done to anybody from Gaza, but the Philistines as a whole were organized in this way against Samson. And they, the men of that city, were taking upon themselves to take care of the problem once and for all. So, as we read about what he did in verse 3, let's read that. Samson lay till midnight. At midnight he arose, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts, and pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that is in front of Hebron. As we read about this, what is missing from this account compared to some of his prior exploits, his prior accomplishments? What's different? I'll give you some hints. Look at who'd like to do a little bit of reading? I need three readers. Anna? Judges 14:6. Casey? Judges 14:9. Anybody else? Got one more verse. Judges 15:14, Charlie. Let's read this. Just read one verse apiece. Chapter 14, verse 6, Anna.
And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. For he had nothing in his hand, but he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done.
Okay, Casey, verse 19 of that chapter.
And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him.
Okay. Charlie, chapter 15, verse 14.
And when he came unto his high, the Philistines fell against him, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. And the cords that were upon his arms became as wax that was burnt with fire, and his bands loosed from his hands.
Okay. So what's different about the account we just read from some of those previous occasions? We don't hear about the Spirit of the Lord rushing upon him. Now, what he's going to do is by the power of God. This is not something he could do by himself, but we don't hear the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. Now, there are a couple incidences in Judges 15 with the foxes and when he kills the men in that town that doesn't mention specifically the Spirit of the Lord, but we see it around it. You know, when the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon Samson, all of a sudden he had the superhuman strength. It seems like, maybe, I don't know, but when Samson became judge or something here, that his strength seemed to become more permanent than transient. It seemed like before, like we'd read about his strength just being, you know, just like he'd get zapped and be super strong. And even he was surprised by it, like when he killed the lion. I mean, he was amazed by what happened. But it seems now that perhaps he's just got that strength all the time, or at least he expects it. It's commonplace to him. In fact, we read later that when he was bound up and Delilah said, "The Philistines are come," he fully expected to shake things off. He had come to expect to have that strength, and he didn't even know that it was gone. And so, there's a whole discussion we could get in about that, but God's enabling this, But we don't read about the Spirit of the God, Spirit of God rushing upon him like other times. Why would God empower Samson to save his life when he is committing a sinful act of fornication? Why would God rescue Samson when he's in the midst of sin? God definitely knew about a bigger plan that he had, and this was all part of what God was leading up to. Any other thoughts or Samson doesn't lose his strength until he loses his hair. If you think about from birth, there was that Nazirite vow put upon him. And even though he had been unfaithful in two out of the three, yet he had remained faithful in that one thing. Now this is nothing great to brag about because he was so unfaithful in so many other ways. But that one thing he had taken seriously, he had never cut his hair. And God remained faithful to empowering Samson, despite Samson's very limited faithfulness. And so I think that may be part of this, that God's faithfulness and graciousness is consistent even when we're not. But that doesn't change what he did. It doesn't make what he did good. It doesn't mean that God was pleased with what he did. And it doesn't mean that what he did wasn't going to cost him. Because Samson kept feeding this demon. Removing and carrying the Gaza gates to Hebron was a huge miracle. Those city gates were large and heavy. What were they designed to do? To what? Keep out the enemies. I mean, these weren't just, you know, like a door we hang on the outside, you know. These were large, heavy gates meant to resist attack. Okay? And they probably were really ornate because in cities, they would transact business. They would exercise government and the city gates. People would meet there. That would be a center of city life. And so these are probably ornate gates that were decorated. Maybe they had, you know, gold or metal or something on them to make them look nice. Gaza was a prominent trade city. And so this is probably pretty significant, big, huge, heavy doors. And he doesn't just pick out the doors. He goes and he picks up the posts out of the ground. I mean, those weren't just, you know, slid in there. I mean, these things are anchored in the ground. And he just goes and lifts this stuff up and he puts it on his back. And it says he carries it to the hill that is in front of Hebron. That's like 40 miles. 40 miles uphill. He's going from down close to the sea up to Hebron. So he carries these crazy, huge, heavy city gates on his back, uphill, 40 miles. I mean, this doesn't even make sense. Why would he carry and take the city gates of Gaza and carry them and plant them on the hill at Hebron? Why take the city gates? I mean, he could just walk out. Anyone tries to attack him, just fling them off like fleas, right? But why take their city gates? It would certainly make a statement, right? It's going to leave Gaza vulnerable. When anyone comes to that town, the first thing they would see, you know, as they were looking toward, they see the walls, and well, there's the gates. That's what you head to. And that was like the heart of the city, in a way, was the city gates. And these people all came to attack him. And Samson goes and takes these things that symbolized the strength and the heart of the city, and he just picks them up by the pillars, puts them on his back, and carries them off to Hebron. You know, that's going to make a huge statement. You know, one of your great cities, all your people, I carried off your city gates. One man of Israel carried off your city gates. I mean, that would break those people kind of emotionally. You just to have someone go and do that. I mean, you'd be thinking, what can we do against this guy? I mean, they'd send 1,000 men and he killed them with the jawbone of a donkey and he carries off city gates. What can we do against this guy? So they're demoralized, but why carry these gates up and plant them in Hebron? Hebron was a major, significant Israelite city. What do we know about Samson? What is he like? Huh?
Vain.
He's vain? This is another selfie moment, right? I mean, he's planting those things on the hill in Hebron where all the Israelites can look and there's the gates of Gaza. Samson standing right next to it, you know? Yeah. Look what I did. I mean, this is total. Look at me. I'm the man. Now, God enabled him to do this, but Samson again is trying to promote himself, just like he was at the Battle of Jawbone Hill when he named the place and he wrote a poem about all the people he killed. You know, he was all about promoting himself. He was a man of lust, and we're going to go on a bit of a tangent now, but any questions or comments before we do that?
I just noticed it was interesting that that's where the men were waiting, to kill him in the morning, and he goes out at midnight, and I guess they must have certainly woke up and didn't do anything about it, did they?
What do you do? Yeah, I mean, it was just, they had to be just total shock to that he just did that.
Yeah, it was quite a hike from Gaza to Hebron.
Yeah. It's just, it doesn't sound like they even tried to run after him or anything. I mean, they were just stunned. Why is this passage here? We've got to stop and consider what's happening in the bigger scope of the Samson narrative. We've got four chapters, 13, 14, 15, and 16, devoted to Samson. This is more time than any other judge in Israel's history gets. There's 12 judges we read about. And some of those judges, you got like sometimes you got like three of them in one verse. You got this one and that one and the other one, you know. But Samson gets four chapters. Look at Judges chapter 3, verse 31. Shamgar, the third judge of Israel. He's got something in common with Samson. Someone read that, Judges 3:31. Tell me about Shamgar. Mary?
After him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 of the Philistines with them.
That guy killed 600 men with an ox goad, and he gets a verse, and Samson gets four chapters. Why? Why does Samson get this much attention? He's obviously not an example, a consistent example of spirituality. Oh, here's a good example of somebody to live just like they lived. That's not why God has put Samson on display. One commentator made this comment. I put it here in quotes. I thought it was so good. I think this really hits the point. When Samson is not saving Israel, he is being Israel. When Samson is not saving Israel, he is being Israel. And that is most of the time. Does that make sense? Samson's problem was Israel's problem. Uncontrolled, sinful desires, failing to take care of business, and continuing to fall for the same trap over and over. And just expecting God to come along and save them and just pull them out and not have any consequences for continuing to do the same sins. And by personalizing Israel, the whole nation's sin problem, in one man, the Lord is helping us to see this bigger picture of where this nation is at as a whole. I mean, we're seeing it play out in the life of one man. And so I think that's at least the primary, one of the primary reasons we have this much time devoted to Samson, is so we can really see what this looks like. You know, I think it's a similar example is like the prophet Hosea. The Lord told him to go and marry a prostitute. And he did. And he had children with her. And this woman was unfaithful to him. She cheated on him. She left him. And Hosea was going through all this stuff. And you ask the question, why did God have this man go marry an unfaithful woman? And the answer was, so that we, because we live in this world and we see and experience and feel different things, so that we could get a sense of how God feels about His people being unfaithful to Him. Because that is called spiritual adultery, when we go and love other things more than God. And so God used Hosea to be an example so that we could kind of feel what that's like. And He does the same thing here with Samson, and letting us see the life of this man in this way, to just go, what's this guy's problem? He keeps falling for the same things. Well, we can do that too. Israel was doing that too. One of the primary points that we get from this chapter is how important spiritual growth is to a Christian. One of the biggest lessons in all of Judges is that when we fail to learn and grow, there will be devastating and enduring effects on our life. God planted this nation in the Promised Land. He gave them victory to overcome the major oppressors, but there was still work to do. And He said, finish it. Keep going. Take over the rest of the land. You're going to grow. You're going to overcome. I want you to finish this off. But if you go back to Judges chapter 2, who would read Judges chapter 2 verses 1 through 3 for us? Josiah? Would you read that?
Now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bashan, and he said, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their gods shall be a snare to you.
The angel of the Lord, which I believe is Jesus Himself, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus, came and explained to them, I told you to take over these other people, but you've not done it. You thought you could let them stay there. You thought you could use them to your purposes and get something out of them. But I tell you, they are going to be a problem to you, and they are going to ensnare you. They will be a thorn and a trap. They're going to cause you pain, and they're going to enslave you, because you did not seek to grow and overcome these things. He gave them time. He gave them opportunity. He gave them the resources, but they got complacent, and their complacency killed them. Samson was a man that was controlled by his sinful desires. He thought, hey, I'm just going to go have some fun. He thought that his sin wouldn't be known because he was far from home. Well, the Philistines all knew exactly where Samson was at. His shame was exposed. He probably thought that his sin would not negatively affect anybody else. And those are the same lies that go through our mind when we fall into sin. We think, oh, I'm just having some fun. Oh, you know, it's not going to hurt anybody else. Nobody's going to know. That's exactly what Samson's doing in Gaza. He thinks he can just hide it all and it's not going to be a big deal. But he didn't realize that going and doing that was affecting his heart. And he did not understand his real condition. What was Samson's real condition? If you go to Revelation chapter 3, who'd like to read verses 15 through 20 in Revelation chapter 3?
I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. Would that you were either cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. For you say, I am rich, I have prospered, and I need nothing, not realizing that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by fire, so that you may be rich, and white garments, so that you may clothe yourself, and the shame of your nakedness may not be seen. And solve to anoint your eyes, that you may see. Those whom I love, I reprove and discipline. So be zealous and repent. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him, and he with me.
When Jesus speaks to the church of Laodicea, the essential message is, you think you're okay, but you're really lukewarm. And that, I think that describes Samson pretty well. I mean, he had stayed faithful to his Nazarite vow. He had been judging Israel, but he was not where he needed to be spiritually. And you think you're okay, and you don't know that you are poor and blind and naked. You don't perceive. Your heart is dull to realizing, to feeling where you're really at. Now, does anyone remember from what we read in chapter 16 where Samson is taken after he's captured? Gaza. Gaza is actually where Samson will die. First time Samson goes down to Gaza, it was a voluntary trip. And he took the city gates with him, and he thought he had control over the situation. But in one way, he never left Gaza, because he ended up going back to Gaza. This time it wasn't for fun. This time it wasn't voluntary. This next time he was blind because his eyes had been put out, and he was shackled in chains. And what we see there on his return trip is a physical representation of where he was on the first trip. Because he was enslaved to his sin. He was following after his lust. He did not realize he was blind. He did not realize he was enslaved. He thought he was having a good time. But on that second trip, he started to realize what was going on the outside with his blindness and his chains was not just true on the outside, but it was true on the inside as well. Sin will take you farther than you want to go and will cost you more than you want to pay. And as we saw in Revelation 3, this is not just an Old Testament problem. It can be very much a New Testament Christian danger too. I want to read a few verses from Romans chapter 8 to you. Romans chapter 8. Paul writes, starting in verse 12, "So then, brothers, we are debtors." We're in debt. "Not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, the flesh, you will live. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs of God, fellow heirs of Christ, provided we suffer with Him in order that we may also be glorified with Him." Paul says to Christians, you are not a slave anymore. You don't have to be a slave. You did not receive a spirit of slavery from God when you got saved. You were adopted. You were made one of His children. Now, if we submit ourselves to following after the flesh, the lusts and desires of the body, the whims that come against us, we can get enslaved to whom we submit ourselves to. We can get tied up again. But we don't have to be slaves to those things. We don't have to be tied up by that. The blood of Jesus Christ can set us free from the sinful desires of our life. We don't have to get stuck in the same pattern and rut. We don't have to be that person. We can grow, we can change, and we need to grow and change. And God's going to give us time. He doesn't expect us when He saves us to just all of a sudden get everything perfectly right. But He does expect us to move forward and to grow. And not to stay in the same place. Because if we stay and we're not taken over ground by growing, these things that are left will become thorns and snares to us. They will cause us pain and they will enslave us. I want to end on this note with Matthew chapter 5. I'll read it again just because it's for the sake of time. I know I'm keeping you longer than I have been lately. Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 through 30. The question is, how does Jesus suggest that we mortify or put to death the deeds of the flesh like Paul spoke of? That was Paul's solution. We need to put to death the deeds of the flesh. Jesus gives us some advice on how to do that. In Matthew 5, verses 27 through 30, Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members, your body parts, than that your whole body go to hell." Now, Jesus is not teaching us to cut off parts of our body. Okay, that is not what Jesus is teaching us. I think you see some real relevance to what's going on with Samson. Right? He just kept following after this lust, what looked good to him. That's what Israel's thing was, right? Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Samson went after what looked good in his eyes. And to Samson, that was Philistine women. And how did God help Samson get past that? He took out his eyes. How do we apply what Jesus is saying in a non-bloody way? In real life, this looks like giving up things, activities, opportunities, and relationships that can tempt you to sin. Each one of us is different, and we are all uniquely tempted. One who is tempted by pornography either needs a heavily filtered and secure internet, or they need to be off the internet altogether. Say, how are you going to survive in today's culture apart from the internet? Well, people did it for thousands of years. If you are drawn into that, that is a killing, life-dominating sin. Take away the opportunity. If you're someone who's tempted to engage in promiscuous activities with people of the opposite sex, you need to limit your ability to be alone with them. Not allow it. You say, well, that's not what I want to do. Well, of course, you want to go sin. And unless you want to get trapped in sin and all the things that go with it, because you're not going to be able to go play with fire and not get burned, you need to do the hard things, say no to things, pull out of things and away from things that tempt you to fall into sin. That's what Jesus is talking about, where you're cutting out an eye, taking off a hand. You're doing things that are hard, that may be painful, but they're meant to save your life from being ruined. Because these things can ruin a life. They can really hurt and hinder a life. If you are one who is tempted to party with a certain set of friends or by being in certain locations, you need to stay away from them. Even after you've been saved, sometimes those temptations will be there to varying degrees or in varying times in your life. Maybe if you go through a difficult time, you're tempted in a certain way where you're not tempted all the time. We all face different temptations. And part of not being a Samson, even after 20 years, the guy went right back to the same thing that brought him down before, is we have to be diligent. You know, I was thinking the other day about the Apostle Paul, where he says, you know, I fought the good fight. I finished my course. And I'm thinking, you know, man, what a statement to make it there and to be able to say that. You know, because it was a fight. He had to fight to the end. I mean, I remember used to think when I was younger, oh man, when I get older, or when this or that, then it'll be easier. Life will be easier. There won't be as many temptations. Ha, 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 ha. If you think that, you're stupid. I was stupid. There's going to be temptation there. You look at all these senators and representatives in our government, all these people in high places, and how old some of those people are. They're still having issues. Right? We live in a sick culture. And if we're going to be salt and light, we're going to have to be different. We can't live the same way the rest of the world does and think, well, just because I'm saved, just because I'm a member of the church, and God's just going to come along and rescue me time after time after time, you may find yourself without your eyes and chained up to a wheel, pushing. But it doesn't have to be that way for us. It doesn't have to be. He has made a way. We have not been called to be slaves. And there can be victory. And we're going to have to be willing to do the hard things, to tell ourselves no, to say no to situations, even if others may mock us, think less of us, who cares? Because at the end of the day, the only thing that is going to matter is to hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant. That's the only voice and the only opinion that is going to matter eternally. Because everybody on that day will have regrets who did not listen to Him in this life. There is nobody on that day, if you have followed Him, who will be mocking you for having done so. Because every knee is going to be on the ground. Every face is going to be toward the ground. Every mouth will be confessing, Jesus is Lord. God allowed Samson to escape the Gazites, who were lying in wait to kill him as he cavorted with the prostitute. Don't confuse God's patience with His permission, because you will reap what you sow. As you can tell, I covered a lot of the concepts of chapter 16, even though we really only just went through the first three verses. And so, we still got to talk about Delilah, all those things. But I think it will go more quickly as we go through the rest of that. Any comments or questions tonight?
I'm thankful that when we get saved, that you don't have to stay where you are. Before you're saved, you don't have a choice. But after you're saved, you do. And the people that forgive that don't have a choice. And it's one of the blessings of being a child of God.
You know, and there's hope in Christ. You know, going through and getting out of bondage, and bondage can take lots of forms, is hard, and it's painful. But there is joy and victory on the other side. And you may still face some temptation, but I tell you, it will get better. There may be times you're tempted sore, but it's still, you can get on the other side and get some peace and get some relief and get some growth. And it's not going to have to be as hard as it is all the time at first. You know, you get some miles behind you. You get some more experience. You get to see the joy. You know, it gets easier. But you never can get to a place where you say, I can't fall anymore. Because there's trouble. There's trouble. And so there's always reason to be humble.